Welcome everyone. I assume everyone can see me and the screen and the links that we'll be looking at. Basically, this chapter of Mishnah makes basically no sense without the careful reading of the biblical verses here. So we're going to start with these verses, and we'll see how the chapter sort of plays out some very specific instructions for the Pesach offering. That's why we're here in Exodus rather than the Mishnah. Remember as well that we're continuing through the sort of chronological picture of the day. We just finished the chapter 6, which was about the preparation, when you can do the Pesach, especially when it's on Shabbat, what things you can do, what things you can't do. So that's all about like the performance of the Pesach sacrifice. And we also saw earlier that after Shabbat was over, they would go home and roast their Pesachs at home. And it seems like that's where they would generally eat their Pesachs. Now we're going on to the next stage, which is the eating of it and the laws of eating of it based on what is going to be very specific Torah instructions. Okay, so with that, we're going to just like skip through a bunch of important details that we need to know, which will help us understand here. So this is the Torah talks about Pesach in a bunch of different places and a bunch of different times. Gives slightly different information. We're going to look at basically sort of two of those times. One of the tricky things about learning laws of Pesach is that there are really two kinds of Pesach. There's the original Pesach, the Pesach Mitzrayim, the Pesach in Egypt, and there's the Pesach Ledorot, the Pesach for the generations, the one that we celebrate. And it's not always obvious which laws apply only to the Pesach Mitzrayim, or which laws are supposed to also apply to us, or us eating the Pesach, which we don't even do anymore. You'll see a little bit of that play out as we go. Okay. So the first important detail is, I just wanted to show you a little bit about where this idea of the chavura, the minyan, the group of people who are all registered for the Pesach comes from. This comes from these verses here. you'll take a lamb for each family. If the household is too small for one lamb, then you can share with your neighbor. So this is already opening up the possibility that you can get a group of people all together to share one lamb. And that's really the origin of this chavura minyan stuff that we've seen so far. Okay. So for example, here's an example of a law which is only true for Pesach Mitzrayim, which is the taking of the of the lamb on the 10th day, Asur LaChodesh Hazeh. That's only true for Pesach Mitzrayim, it's not true for Pesach Ledorot. Okay. And also the blood on the doorpost, obviously the other key difference. This is also important, V'achlu et ha-basar b'layla hazeh. You have to eat it that night, which means before midnight, as we'll see eventually. Tzli eish u'matzot al-marim yochluhu. It is roasted by fire, roasted on the fire, and with matzot and murarim, the bitter things, yochluhu. You'll eat them. And then it becomes oddly specific, because if it just had this verse over here and it just said roast on the fire, you think, oh yeah, most of the time you roast lambs, and that's why we're talking about roasting. But then it becomes very extremely specific about why it should be roasted, or that it has to be roasted specifically. Do not eat of it raw or cooked in any way in water. It has to be roasted head, leg, and entrails and innards. It has to be roasted on the fire. So this is going to play up in the first few Mishnayot here. And you can't leave anything until the morning. And anything left over, you have to burn in fire. You can't eat it. Okay. So that's the first set of important things about the roasting, and it includes the legs and the entrails, the insides of the intestines, has to be roasted by fire. Okay, so the question we're going to see is sort of how far does this, what does it mean to be roasted by fire? How far away from the fire can it be? How far removed from the fire can it be before it's no longer roasted by fire? The other important thing we're going to see is the two rules here. Bavayit echad yeachel has to be eaten in one house. Lo totzi min habayit min habasar chutza. You can't take it out from the house, from any of the flesh outside. Now, you might think this is only about Pesach Mitzrayim, because the whole point is that you're sort of hiding in your houses from the destroyer. But in fact, the Mishnah is going to assume that this is true for all Pesachs. Like, once it's sort of roasted in your house, it can't leave. And if it leaves, then you're going to have to burn it, or at least burn the part that left. So we're going to get to that towards the end of the chapter. And another very important rule, the etzem lo tishberuvo. You cannot break a bone of it. That's another very important rule of the Pesach. Whatever you do in order to prepare it, if you break a bone, you are violating a prohibition of the Torah, and you may be lashed for doing so intentionally. Okay? So those are the main things we need to know about the roasting, the one house, and the no broken bones. And that's what the chapter is basically going to play out, those three rules. Okay, to the Mishnah. Ketzad solin et ha-pesach. How do they roast the Pesach sacrifice? Mevi'in shvud shel rimon, tochavo mitoch piv ad beit nekuvato, v'notein et kra'av et b'nei me'av letocho. They bring a spit of pomegranate wood. Not pomegranate, but pomegranate wood. And they sort of stick it in its mouth all the way to its back, all the way to its anus, like through the animal. And they put the its legs and its innards inside it. So they sort of like put all of the legs and the inside parts of the animal inside the animal to roast it all like that. And that's based on the Torah talking about how you have to roast the legs and innards with it. That is Divrei Rabbi Yossi Haglili. That's what Rabbi Yossi Haglili would recommend. But Rabbi Kiva Omer, Kamin Bishul Huzeh. The legs and the entrails that are inside the animal, that's essentially cooking, right? They're in the sort of their own cooking pot. They will boil with the liquid inside the animal, with the fat or the blood. Well, there's no blood, but the fat and the other liquids there. Those things will boil. So that's too much like cooking. You can't do that. Ella tolan chutzalo. Rather, what you do is you hang the legs and entrails sort of outside the offering, so that they are cooked directly on the fire. So here they seem to be arguing about, what does it mean to say it's cooked directly on the fire? Is it enough to say that the entire animal is cooked in the fire, even though inside it might be sort of bubbling and boiling? Or is Rabbi Kiva would say, that's not good enough. Actually, everything has to be directly on the fire. Okay. And why is it also another key question is that it's the Rabbi Kiva does not seem to disagree with the fact that it should be a wooden spit. And presumably the other option would be a metal spit. And we'll see in a second the problem with a metal spit in the next Mishnah. Yes, you are supposed to clean and wash the innards before, which means you've taken them out, which means that Rabbi Yossi Haglili thinks you have to put them back inside the animal. Correct. And Rabbi Kiva would just say you hang him out. Yes, the first way is they take off the legs and they put it inside. Or maybe they take it off. I'm not sure, actually. Maybe they just tuck it in. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly the mechanics, having never roasted a lamb on a spit myself. Okay. Great. That sounds like a nice technical word, trussing. Okay. Great. So now we'll get on to the other materials one might use for a spit and that maybe you can't. Ein solin et ha-pesach lo al ha-shvud v'lo al ha-askala. So the shvud, if you just had a spit by itself, you would assume metal, right? When Rabbi Yossi Haglili said above that it was a wooden spit, he had to clarify it was a spit of pomegranate wood. So this is a metal spit. And also you can tell that because it's also compared to an askala, which is a metal grill. So this is saying you cannot roast the Pesach on a metal grill. What's the problem with a metal grill? It seems like the entire metal gets white hot, and what ends up, or red hot, but what ends up cooking the animal is the metal and not the fire. Whereas if it's wood, then the fire is the only thing roasting the animal, and the It doesn't get hot in that way. It doesn't cook from the wood. So that, again, they're sort of expanding what it means to be cooked by fire. Here, the Tanakama here, the first opinion, is that metal seems to, if you put metal on there, the metal actually cooks the meat and not the fire. And we have to have the fire cooking the meat. This is a great technique, by the way, for making, I'm British, so obviously I have strong opinions about potatoes. The best baked potatoes you can make is with metal spit through, because literally this happens. The inside of the potato gets cooked by the metal of the spit, and the outside gets crispy by the oven. Try it if you've never done it before. It's a good Pesach recipe. Great. Why pomegranate wood? So it's possible that pomegranate wood is just like an example of a wood that would work in spits, on a spit, like it wouldn't burn up in the fire. Possible that it's like not moist, so it doesn't, it like takes you further away from any sort of cooking with water concerns, whatever. There could be a bunch of reasons for that. Totally unclear. Okay, so that's the first opinion. You can't do it on these metal spits or metal grills. But Amar Rabbi Tzadok, Maaseh b'Rabban Gamliel she'amar l'tavi avdo tsei utzlei lanu et ha'pesach al ha'askala. Rabbi Tzadok refers to a case that actually happened, where Rabban Gamliel, who was the important guy in Yavne, he told his servant Tavi, his slave, to go and roast for us a Pesach on the metal grill. So it seems like Rabban Gamliel did not think that this was a big deal. Yeah, jacket potato, thank you, Dave. Didn't think this was a big deal. The metal grills were totally fine. It's on the fire, it's enough. There are a couple of things about this. The first thing is that you could have sort of had this in the form of, you know, Rabban Gamliel Omer. Rabban Gamliel says you can even do it on a grill. That could have been the way this Mishnah was structured. The reason it's structured in sort of story form is because a story, a maaseh, is the strongest evidence you can have of a position. If somebody in the Mishnah, the way the Mishnah thinks about it, if somebody just says something, they say it. They might think that theoretically, but there's no necessarily evidence that they actually acted upon that opinion. But if you bring a story, an actual maaseh of this thing happening, then you're not only saying that they think this is theoretically true, they think this is practically actionable. This is halakha maaseh, you might say. So it's actually the strongest kind of evidence you can bring is when a rabbi actually did something, not just when he said something. Yes, the other thing about this is that you'll see in the Talmud they try to reread this so that it isn't a machloket so much, and that Rabban Gamliel does actually agree that you can't cook on metal. But don't worry about that. I think that this is the clean sense of the Mishnah, where the first opinion is this is terrible, like metal will be cooking and not the fire. And the other one saying, what are you talking about? It's roasting, it's on a fire. Like, what else do you need from me? How else do you roast things? You roast things on metal grills. Okay, is Tavi a servant or a slave? For them, there's basically no difference, but certainly we would say slave. like they use the same word, evet, so there's no conceptual difference for them. But yes, Ebet, he's a non-Jewish slave. He tells a bunch of stories. He's a recurring character. It's possible that Tavi is also just like a generic name that people use for slaves in the Roman world. So there's some generic names that sort of get associated with certain roles in fiction and stories. So that could be the case here as well. Okay. So that's about the metal and the wood. Now we talk about, we're roasting it in the oven, presumably. Oven is made of clay. Now we're gonna talk about what happens if the Pesach interacts with the clay of the oven. Naga b'charso shalatanur yiklof et makomo. If the Pesach offering, if part of the Pesach touched the clay of the oven, you have to cut off that place. This is the place that touched the oven. This is a thing called a klipa. Klipa is one of the things that you can use in kashrut. If like your kosher thing came in contact with a non-kosher thing, sometimes klipa is all you need. Just cutting off a layer is all you need in order to eat the rest of it, depending on the circumstance. So here, it's basically like, well, if it touched the oven, it's no longer roasted by the fire. It's now being cooked by the oven, by the clay. And so that's also a problem. So therefore, you can just cut off the bit of the Pesach that touched the oven, and you can eat the rest. So it's a very low-level amount you have to do. But then there are other issues that might arise. Nataf meirotbo al acheres v'chazar alav yitol et makomo. Now a bit of the gravy, the juice of the meat, sort of drips onto the clay and then goes and reabsorbs it with the Pesach. It sort of goes back on the Pesach somehow, like maybe the bit of the Pesach touched it or whatever, and it gets reabsorbed by the animal. Then yitol et makomo. You have to do netila, which is another thing you can sometimes do when kosher things touch non-kosher things, which you can take out a larger section, sort of like go in, you know, several layers deep and take out a whole bunch, rather than just like a quick sort of cutting off a layer. Okay, because presumably the juice has been was cooked on the oven and then got reabsorbed into the animal, and therefore it's sort of become close to cooking with water instead of cooking by fire. Okay, and it's been reabsorbed more as opposed to just touch it. It's been absorbed into the meat as opposed to just touching the oven. That's why it seems like you have to do a larger amount than just cutting off a layer. Okay, nataf meirot bo al hasolet yikmotz et makomo. This is now a different case where some juice fell onto the dripped onto the flour. The flour was boiling. It was roasted by the flour at that point. It'll be forbidden to eat it because it hasn't been roasted by fire. So therefore, you have to get a handful out of the flour and then burn it probably later. Okay, so this is just all the situations where. Your otherwise perfectly roasted on the fire thing becomes sort of contaminated by cooking through other things. Yes, that could be a problem. So you have to be careful about it. Okay. Turns out there are a lot of things you have to be careful about when it comes to the Pesach offering. Okay. But even though we're worried about liquid contamination and then for turning it into cooking with water instead of roasting, what you can do is sort of baste it with oil to help it cook. That is just part of roasting rather than adding liquid to it. So that seems to be a thing that you can certainly do. But now we're going to try and talk about some corner cases about what happens here with the oil. So, Sachon v'shemen truma im chavurat kohanim yochelu im Yisrael im chayhu yidichenu im tzlihu yiklof et achitzon. Now, you basted it with oil, but the oil happened to be truma. It happened to be only edible by priests. So now what are you going to do once the oil is already on there? If the group of the people registered for the Pesach, the Chavura, if they're all priests, totally fine. You can just eat it. They can all eat truma oil. They can eat it. But if the group is non-priests, they're just lay people, if the meat is still raw, you can just wash the oil off. You can just sort of like rinse it off quickly, and then you can make sure to dry it before putting it back on the roasting thing. So this is like this amount of liquid is not contamination. Or if it's roasted, if it's already hot, then you can just do klipa. You could just take off a layer on the outside. So you can just take off the truma oil. Okay. Now another problematic oil that you might have used. Sacho b'shemen shel ma'aser sheni. Lo ya'asenu damim al b'nei chavura, she'ein po din ma'aser sheni v'Yerushalayim. So this requires knowledge of the laws of second tithe, ma'aser sheni. Second tithe, you have to eat it in Jerusalem. But what you're allowed to do is you're allowed to redeem the item. So you say you have like an animal, which is going to be, or in this case, let's say you have a jug of oil, which is going to be second tithe. What you can do is you can sell it outside Jerusalem, and then the money that you sold it for becomes holy. Then you can get to Jerusalem, use that holy money to buy more oil, which then takes on the status of the original oil. And then you can use that oil in Jerusalem rather than having to lug your oil all the way from wherever you are to Jerusalem. You can sort of do this redemption by money. But you can't redeem them once you're already in Jerusalem. That's already too late. Once you've already brought the oil all the way to Jerusalem, then you have to eat that oil. or you can't sell it anymore. So it's totally fine to eat this oil, but the problem is if you wanted to sell it. So this is what they say. If he basted it in oil of second tithe, they can't make the money, the damim, the value, over the B'nai Chavura. In other words, they can't, he can't charge the group for the value of this oil. She'ein podin ma'aser sheni v'Yerushalayim, because you can't redeem ma'aser sheni if you're already in Jerusalem. You have to have done that beforehand. So it seems like there's also like some financial transactions around the Pesach as well, where people would like pay you for their registration, which makes sense if you're the owner of the sheep. Okay, keeping on going. Okay, so this is now, we're going to start talking about some of the differences and similarities between Pesach and sacrifice and other sacrifices. Chamisha dvarim ba'in betuma ve'einan ne'echalin betuma. Here are five things which may come in uncleanness and may not be eaten in uncleanness. So the point is here that there are a whole bunch of reasons why a sacrifice might not be valid. It might be that the people who brought them are unclean. It might be that the vessels in the temple are unclean for some reason, or the priests are unclean. So there are all sorts of reasons that this might happen. So the question is, these are sacrifices which have to be brought at specific times, just like the Pesach. And you still bring them even if, the priests and the vessels or the people bringing them are impure and therefore would make the sacrifice invalid. You still bring them, but normally you would eat them, but nonetheless you do not eat them if you were impure when you brought them. So the sacrifice is valid, but you can't eat it. And the through line here is these are sacrifices that have specific times when they have to be performed. And here are the five things. Ha'omer u'shtei ha'lechem v'lechem ha'panim v'zivchei shalmei tzibur u'sirei rashei chadashim. The Omer, which is the sacrifice you'd have to bring on the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach, or the first or second day Yom Tov for us, you'd have to bring the new grain offering in order to permit the people to eat the new grain. That's the Omer. So it has to be brought on exactly the right day, on the 16th of Nisan. Ushtei HaLechem, the two bread that were brought on Shavuot to also sort of symbolically bring in the new grain harvest. So they have to be brought exactly on Shavuot. The lechem hapanim, the showbread, they have to be brought out every single week. The bread on the table in the temple, they have to be there. They have to be replaced every single week. So there's a fixed time every week where you have to replace the showbread. The zivchei shalmei tzibur, the sacrifices of shlamim, public shlamim offerings. Remember, the shlamim offering is like the Pesach, that the priest eats some and the owner eats some. The time when you would bring public shlamim offerings, most public offerings are olah. They're just burnt up totally on the altar, which is like the tamid happening twice a day and the musaf happening on Shabbat and things like that. But some of them are eaten by the priests. And the case where this would happen is also Shavuot. You would bring shlamim public sacrifices on Shavuot. So again, that has a fixed time and the priests would normally eat them. Usurei Rashei Chodashim, and the goats for the new moons. The extra goats you bring on the new moons, again, the priest would eat them normally if they were pure. So all of these sacrifices have fixed times where you have to bring them. Even if the priests or the vessels or the people are impure, you still bring them, but you don't eat them if you're impure. Okay, so they're valid sacrifices, but they can't be eaten. Now, you may notice a few things that are similar about these things as they are to the Pesach. The Pesach is another sacrifice which the people eat some of and has to be brought at a specific time. So now we're going to see what you have to do with the Pesach. HaPesach sheba betuma ne'echal betuma shelova bitchilato ela la'achila. The Pesach offering, however, if it was bought when the community was impure or the priests were impure, or the vessels in the temple were impure, any of those circumstances, you would still eat it, regardless. The whole point of the Pesach sacrifice is to be eaten. That's the fundamental point of Pesach, is to eat the Pesach sacrifice on Pesach night. Unlike those other sacrifices, which their main point is to be sacrificed, and a sort of side benefit is that you get to eat them, here the only reason we're doing it is to eat it. So this case, we'll see this in later on in the Mishnah, but basically the point is that we know about Pesach Sheni. So let's talk about Pesach Sheni for a second. So Pesach Sheni, as we can see now, is for when some individuals are impure. Some individuals who are impure, they can not do Pesach Rishon and then do Pesach Sheni instead. But if the whole community is impure or the temple itself is impure, then they actually just get on and do Pesach anyway. And there's no Pesach Sheni. You just have to get it done. And we'll see this like explained explicitly in a Mishnah. In fact, let's do this right now. So we're going to do the Mishnah slightly out of order because sometimes the Mishnah are not in the order that makes sense because every Mishnah basically assumes you've learned every other Mishnah. So they're not always in the correct order when you're trying to learn from start to scratch. But here is the rule. Nitzmar kahal or rubo, if the entire community or most of the community became impure, or shehayu kohanim tmeim ba'akal kahal torim, or the priests were impure, but the community was pure, yaseh v'tumah. They do it, they do the Pesach anyway, even in a state of impurity. Nitzmar mi'uta kahal, but if only a minority of the community are impure, ha'torin osinat ha'rishon v'tmein osinat ha'sheni. Then the pure group do the first Pesach, and the impure group can wait until the second Pesach and do the catch-up. There's a lot of talk about how we should have Pesach Sheni, how we should have Pesach Sheni now, because this Pesach is not ideal. And this would argue against that, because like basically the entire community is unable to, is unable to practice a good Pesach. So it seems like here, actually, this is not a good argument for deferring Pesach. What you could do is what we saw a few weeks ago, which is when you can add an extra Nisan month, which was what Chizkiah did, but they didn't agree with him, so that didn't work either. Okay, how does the whole community become pure in one shot? I don't know. Battle. They all touch corpses in a battle. Happened on the 13th of Nisan. It's more theoretical than it is practical, I think. If some people are hospital, they can defer it. So yeah, so there's definitely some precedent for like doing some kind of celebration on Pesach Sheni. People sometimes do seventh night seders. I've seen this happen of like people who maybe they couldn't, it wasn't ideal for their first night seders. So they have like a seventh night seder with their community or something, or they have to be their family on first night, so they're with their community on seventh night. This seems to suggest, why don't you just do Pesach Sheni? That sounds great. Great. Yes, so also the other thing is, as Sarah, you mentioned, we're all by default touching corpses all the time. We have no sense of what's pure or what's impure anymore. So yeah, so there's no good basis for moving Pesach anymore, unfortunately. Okay, great. So we're going to continue back slightly out of order. We'll continue back with this Mishnah tomorrow. Hope everyone's Pesach preparation is going well. Hopefully we'll finish the whole chapter. There are only 10 chapters. We're in chapter 7, so hopefully we can finish them by Wednesday, but we'll see.